Accession number 29234, Reel 3.
Previous war work with the auxiliaries must have been very good training for the radar, I would think.
Yes, I suppose it was in a way. But I loved it. I loved the radar work, and I loved those old CH sets because I found I could do so much with them. I had very sensitive fingers, I think, and a lot of it was this goniometer thing that you had to work. And I think, you know, I'd got a very, very soft touch with that, because when the 1,000 bomber raids went out, they were stacked over a lot of the time. They were stacked over the North Sea, just out over the Wash. And I could get top and bottom heights and estimate the numbers much, much better than other people could. And when there was any sort of an emergency on, I was always put to work the machine. And when the invasion force went out again, I went on. I think I went on at 11, the beginning of the watch, and I stayed on until the planes moved off out of our radius, our range.
11 p.m. would it? Yes. Night.
Yes, it was a night. I was on the nights, and I saw this terrific mass going, and I was getting sort of the four corners and the top and bottom. And I was estimating the thousands that were going up. And the operator, the officer in charge, got a message through from the filter room to say, would she check their operator's plots? They thought there was something phony about them. So she came and just tested out. She said, went back and said, no, my operator is entirely accurate, apart from the fact that she may be underestimating the numbers. And I was kept on until they moved off. I was operating, we were only supposed to do an hour at a time because it was bad for your eyes, but I was on till after 3 in the morning when the last planes disappeared. Yes. The big mass went out, and then there were other planes going out that I stayed on, and then there were planes coming in showing the distress signal. And I found again, whereas most people's plots, they got on the map, they'd get the plots that sort of shape, you know. I get mine almost dead straight, which with a plane that was in distress was very valuable. And another extraordinary time, I got a plane showing at 50 feet. Well, we weren't supposed to be able to pick anything up at that height. You know, we had to go much higher than that. And it was the coastal plane stations that picked up the low ones. And again, a message came through from the filter room saying, you know, please check this, your operator's plots, because the CHL stations aren't showing it. Anyway, she came and checked it and said, no, it's absolutely right. And so then they said, well, tell your operator to concentrate on that one and not to plot anything else. So it was a plane in distress being followed by a Messerschmitt. And they were very close together. And I suppose the plane that was in distress was so low that the Messerschmitt was trying to get in position to shoot them down. But it was very interesting because none of the CHL stations could see it. But the coverage was most extraordinary. I think it was one reason that the CH stations were being phased out, that you did get this faulty coverage, and one station I was at in Yorkshire, Danby Beacon, that was ghastly. I mean, nobody ever bothered to take our plots. We sat there plotting away, and they knew darn well they weren't worth having. You know, it was a complete waste of time. I was jolly glad to get away from there, because it was above the clouds most of the time.
I suppose the area was really important.
We were right on top of Danby Beacon. I went back there some years later, and it took me a long while to realise that the road we were driving on was where we had the huts, each side of the road. And we got up, I said, no, we turned right at the end here, up to the op station. And we got out and we walked across and we found the hardcore bases of where the big pylons, the four big pylons had been. And because it was a clear day, we could see right across to Whitby. I said, I've never seen that before. I didn't realise how close it was, because we were always above the clouds, usually raining. We were perpetually wet. There was perpetually a river running down the road, you know. At one point it came through our hut. When we went out, we had to put all our things on our beds, because otherwise they'd get soaked. Oh, it was a hellish station.
I suppose the sighting of radar is so important,
yes,
isn't it?
Yep.
You know, to get the right...
Mustn't have buildings in the way. You see, we could only plot over the sea. We couldn't plot over land because the buildings got in the way.
How were you selected for radar? You know,
if I had aptitude tests.
Yes.
Previously, they'd only been people with university education, and they were starting to realise that they were short of operators, and so they gave us aptitude tests both for radio operators and radar, and they gave me the choice of radio or radar, and I'd hated doing the aptitude tests for radio. I couldn't, because I didn't know whether I was right or wrong. I had got confidence. They said, why are you picking radar? I said, well, I think because I shall be able to find out what I'm doing. I said, with this radio business, I don't know whether I'm making mistakes. And I said, I'm the sort of person who's got to have it right. I said, I'm a bit of a perfectionist, and things have got to be done properly or not at all. So they said, well, right, you know, you've made the right choice, obviously. And
was the training very long for radar?
No. No, we were... I and one or two others were sent up to Northumberland to a station called Ottercops Moss, which was about 27 miles north of Newcastle, quite near Otterburn, about 3 miles from Otterburn. And the only place to go and get any exciting life was in Otterburn, where there was a YMCA. And the WAF were allowed to go in there to get a cup of coffee and an award. But the only thing was, there were only loos for the gents. And, of course, by the time you'd drunk two or three coffees, and there were no hedges, only stone walls and not very high ones at that, one was in a fairly desperate state. And so we went to one or two of the cottages one day, and they said, no, they were sorry, we couldn't use theirs because they had only one, not a water closet at that, between seven houses. And it was all emptied once a week. Try the vicarage. The vicar had got a water closet. So we went to the vicarage, and a gorgeous, rotund little vicar came to the door, and I explained what our problem was. "Oh, of course, my dears. Yes, I sympathise. Yes, just a minute, I'll get my housekeeper." So along came his housekeeper and showed us into this, what was obviously had been a sort of lobby storage room. And the loo was up three steps, I suppose to get enough fall, you see, because the land sloped up behind the vicarage. And so anyway, we clambered up the steps. One side was the Bible and the Book of Sermons, and the other side was his pipe and tobacco. Anyway, he was sort of hovering in the hall when we came out, and he said, "Now, don't forget, my dears, don't suffer in silence. You're always welcome." Oh, we had some fun up there. I wanted to find a horse to ride in the spare time, and I saw what turned out to be the nonconformist minister walking along with a bridle over his shoulder. So I went up to him. I said, "Excuse me, sir, but I see you've got a bridle over your shoulder. Do you know if there's anywhere that I can beg, borrow, or steal a horse to have a ride now and again?" "Oh, well," he said, "I'm sorry, I can't lend you mine because it's hard at work all the time visiting all the outlying farms and cottages across the moors." But he wrote something on a piece of paper. He said, "This is the telephone number of Miss Mitford at West Woodburn. And she has a lot of ponies, and I'm sure she'd be delighted to see you." So I rang Miss Mitford, and she came over in her little car, which was had definitely seen better days. And she took me over to see the ponies, and I had a ride on one of them. And she said she'd been evacuated off the Isle of Skye at the beginning of the war. The horses had had to be lifted out on slings onto the ferry, and she'd found this, I don't know how she'd found this or whether she was billeted on this lady who had a bungalow and a couple of fields, and the army had put up some temporary stables for her, and she'd had the stallion, Highland stallion, which had been on the island of Rum for 3 years. And then, of course, when his daughters came round for breeding, he was surplus, so she had him back. But, of course, having to have him in such close contact with all her mares, at 12 he'd had to be gelded, poor dear. And he was very morose. And, of course, he had to be in the box all the time. He hardly ever went out. And so she said, "You know, do keep clear of him, because if you go near enough, he'll have you." And I heard afterwards that he'd kicked the back out of his box and fallen down into the ravine below and broken his back. But he was, funnily enough, he's in the back breeding of my pony, if you go far enough back, by my broodmare.
Is the horses you rode when you were doing your messenger, you were saying you had a chestnut stallion.
Yes.
And your black one, which you used for your night rides.
Yes.
Did you? Yes, that they were very lucky to have someone like you with your riding experience and the horses.
Well, I think John Collings spotted it, you see. He realised that from the point of view of practical knowledge and sensible attitude, that I was, I suppose, fairly unusual.
An ideal, you know. Candidate. Well, you must have been by far the youngest recruit.
Oh, I would think so, yes. I mind you, I don't know. Because we never knew anybody else. I remember Dad saying that, and he'd heard that there was one vicar who had his sit in his belfry, because of course the bells were not allowed to be rung, you see. And I'm almost certain that that would have been the Reverend Humphrey Barclay at Southrepps, because from his belfry you could see out to sea, and he would be an ideal place to spot.
And his name was Barclay?
Yes, Humphrey Barclay.
Oh, yes.
He was subsequently chaplain to the Queen, but he was a lovely man. He always had a horse and he hunted. I remember before Godfrey and I married, we went, because he said to Dad he'd seen my engagement in the paper. And he said, "You're descended from Parson Jack Russell, aren't you?" So Dad said, "Well, yes, he was my mother's great uncle." "So, yes," he said, "sporting parson." He said, "Your daughter should be married by a sporting parson." He said, "I will marry her." And of course, there was a certain amount of annoyance by the local vicar, but anyway, he did.
Very appropriate.
And we had to go over to see him and have lunch. And after lunch, he said, "Right, now we'll go across to the church." He said, "It's rather a lovely church. I'd like you to see it. We can have a chat over there." And on the way, he said, "Oh, I'll show you the nearest thing to an angel on earth." And he'd got a Labrador with him. He opened a stable door, and over the top of the door came a greyhound. And both of them, and a terrier, they all came into church and sat down. And we looked sort of a bit surprised. And he said, "Oh, dogs always used to come to church." He said, "We've even still got the dog tongues that we used to separate the dogs that had fights in the middle of the service." And he said, "We've got quite a lot of rings still left that dogs were tied to." And we had a little chat then, and off we went. But I've never forgotten when we went to the gate into the churchyard, a little side gate, he was making the greyhound jump backwards and forwards over the gate.
You were saying you didn't know the other people. Have you since learnt of other women involved in this?
Well, there's one lady I'm still friendly with who was, I think she was in the Fannies at the beginning of the war, and she was a radio operator with the ATS and with the Army.
But not in the auxiliaries?
No.
No, I was wondering.
She was on the other end of our job, you see. And also she was trawling the wavelengths to pick up any foreign speech. And I said, "Oh, see if there are any spies." I said, "Did you ever get any?" And she said, "Well, I never knew, definitely. But," she said, "I did pick up two lots of somebody speaking German." But he said, "When we did that, we had to switch it straight through to headquarters. And they acted on it."
And did she know of the auxiliary role? Did she
know
that? No, she wouldn't.
Not till after the war.
She would just have been, doing her job.
Yes.
Normally.
Yeah.
Yes.
And she didn't know where she was either. She was stationed. She didn't know where she was stationed. She was taken there in a lorry. And her place of operations was a hut with a tin roof in a wood. And she was picked up by Army lorry and taken back to her billet. And that was her life. She hadn't a clue where she was.
Yes, we ought to talk to her, it seems. Yes.
She's down in Sussex now.
Perhaps later on I could
ask. Yes, I've got her. I've got her name and address.
That would be, the other thing.
She's very, very crippled now.
Oh. I was wondering, were you ever taught to defend yourself?
Yes, I learnt rifle shooting and revolver.
Did that come easily to you?
Yes. Not so much the rifle shooting, but the revolver I found I was pretty accurate.
And would you have carried one with you when you went out?
No.
That would have been in case of invasion.
Yes, yes. Yes, we went down to Marsham. There's a rifle range down there. And we went down there to learn the rifle shooting. I had two sessions. And two sessions with the revolver.
And also, bearing in mind the risk you ran if there was an invasion, because after all, if you were caught and interrogated, you would have been a spy. Am I right in thinking that?
Well, I remember laughingly saying to John, what happens if they decide that I'm a spy? He said, well, you'll be put up against a wall and shot.
And you knew that, did you?
Yeah.
That you would be shot. And you were still prepared?
Well, I suppose one felt it was such a remote possibility. You know, we were sort of fed by the government that we were fully prepared to repel an invasion, etc., etc., etc. So we were, I, in my innocence, believed them.
Your father must have been under quite a lot of strain, I think.
He was much more... He didn't talk about it, but I know, you know, he was much more sort of clued up.
More involved?
Yeah.
And he never spoke about it?
No.
Did this happen for a long time, that everyone kept very quiet about the... No.
Yes, well, you see, I never talked about it. I mean, I was married in 1948, and I'd been married quite 10 years before I discovered that we'd actually been stood down and it was all right to talk about it.
You kept quiet all that time?
Yeah.
Yes.
But funnily enough, my husband was in the bombing squad in the Home Guard, and they were the ones who would act on the clues that we came up with. They had their hideout in the woods, because they were farming at Benicker Hall Farm then in Suffolk, and they had a hideout in the woods, underground, hidden, you know.
So he would have been an auxiliary.
And in the event of an invasion, he would have had to go to ground and stay there and just come out when they were told of somewhere that they'd got to go and attack.
Those hideouts, are they still about?
It's a funny thing. I came across, at Aylsham's show, I came across the Highland mare that I've got now, who'd come to the show with her daughter, who was being shown, and Mummy would just come to keep her company. Mummy was standing around grazing outside, and I was talking to another Highland judge who was there, and I said, you know, if that pony's missing from her field in the morning, I said, they'll know where to look for her, because I said, I've always wanted one that colour. So I said, Miss Mitford would have lent me one. And I think that's it. In a minute, I'll have to leave you.